around Sukkot time is really more of a Beit HaMikdash time, so we'll leave off the Beit HaMikdash until Sukkot, and we'll continue on with the narrative, and we're almost up to the split of the kingdom. So we're on chapter... Good evening, how are you? I'm sorry, do you want me to clear away some of that table? It's really, it's become a real, kind of a dumping ground. Looks like my house after my cleaning ladies are finished with it. No, that's not really fair at all. Malachim Aleph, 1 Kings, chapter 11, verse 29. Now, we've actually done a few of these verses, because when we were looking at the sins of Shlomo, we were noting that the word of God that came to Shlomo was very similar to the words that Achiah HaShiloni, this prophet that shows up in verse 29, tells to Yeravam. Harold was not convinced that I was right, but my guess is that Achiah HaShiloni was actually the prophet that told Shlomo what he said. So just to go through it again, there are a few interesting points, some grammatical, some on language, and a few other things which are worth noting. But I think hopefully we'll spend, if I don't take too much time on it, we'll spend a little time on chapter 12, which is where the rebellion actually begins. So Vayihi, in verse 29, Vayihi Beitahi v'Yeravam Yatsa Miyushalayim. He's on his way out of Yushalayim. Vayimtsa Uto Achiah Shiloni Hanavi. Achiah from Shiloh finds him. And Achiah is wearing a new cloak, and they're alone in a field. It's your classic conspiracy, actually. Chapter 11, verse 29, in Malachim Aleph, Kings 1, 11:29. And by the way, what's interesting here is what we saw in verse 27. No. In verse 26, it says, "Vayarem yad b'melech." He raised his hand against the king. Now, there are various ways of understanding this, and I explained one chazal about how he came, and he yelled at the king for not allowing people in the Beit HaMikdash because he was so busy with Bat Paro. But I think the simple understanding of "Vayarem yad b'melech" doesn't mean he literally raised his hand to hit him, but it means he began a rebellion. My guess is that things are out of order, and here is where the rebellion begins. That is, usually people are inspired to rebel, and Yeravam seems to be a pretty loyal soldier, to be perfectly honest. I think when Achiah Shiloni comes to him and tells him that you have to rebel, that's when it all begins. What makes me think that it's actually out of order? What makes me think it's actually out of order is that verse 28 is clearly before verse 27. How do we know that? Verse 27 is, the whole thing is backwards. Verse 26 is the latest. Then comes verse 27, then verse 28. Those three verses are specifically, good evening. We have many more seats. Here. Did a few extra so people walk in. Why do I say that it's specifically out of order? Well, verse 26 says that that Yeravam, we're in chapter 11, now we're starting verse 29, but I'm a very jumpy person, so I jump back to 26. So in 26 there's a rebellion. 27 describes the cause for the rebellion. You see that? 27 says, V'zeh ha'davar sherim b'yad melech. This is the reason why he had a rebellion. So 27, verse 27 is clearly before 26. 26 says there was a rebellion. 26 says the reason why there's a rebellion. And 28 describes Yeravam and how he got his job. Vayihi Yeravam gibur chayel vayar shlomo et anar. He saw that he was a good worker. Ki osem lachahu vayifkedo toluchol sel vayasef. He put him in charge of all of Vayasef, which clearly comes before the rebellion and probably before, good evening, probably before the cause for the rebellion also. So as you see, verse 26, verse 27, and verse 28 are actually backwards.
Well, you know, it's possible for you to tell somebody, oh, there was a rebellion. You know why it happened? It happened because of such and such, where the cause came after the...
Yeah, I agree. First you set up the story, and then you give the reasoning behind the story.
So it's not necessarily that those other psukim came first. You mean they just in the way the story goes?
The way the story... Yeah, I'm not trying to say that... Yes, I'm not trying to say that the author somehow took psukim in existence and put them in a reverse order.
I see.
This isn't...
Fine.
you're right. I'm not trying to describe your classic Ein Mukdam U'Muchar B'Torah. This is an editorial decision to first tell, hey, there's rebellion, and then to explain why.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I believe, though, I think that gives me room to say that what happens in verse 29 and afterwards is also proceeding. Now, I have no proof of that, but it strikes me that it's not that Yeravam started the rebellion, and then on the way out of town, Achia Shiloni said, you know what, your rebellion's a great idea for the following reasons. I don't think that that's true at all. Not only, the reason why I don't think that's true is because if we take a look at verse 29, Vayihi be'etahi v'yeravam yatsam Yerushalayim v'yimtza Achia Shiloni anavi baderech. He found him on the way. On the way where? On the way north, right? He's Achia Shiloni. Now Shiloh, if you map out Israel, I don't know if modern Shiloh actually is where ancient Shiloh was as well, more or less. If you're in Yerushalayim, you drive that windy road going up to Shechem. About halfway between Yerushalayim and Shechem is Shiloh. Nice little mountain town that you get to. I would say probably, as the bird flies, are probably just 10 miles. But since the car drives it on a wind, it takes, I think, about 25 minutes, maybe half an hour to get there, although I could be overstating it. It's south of Shechem. It's in between Yerushalayim. It's about halfway in between Yerushalayim and Shechem, to the north. Actually, exactly where it is going to come in. Well, actually, I'll leave that alone. So he's not on the run. We're going to find out that after he leads his rebellion, it's not like he just goes back home. We're actually going to see that he runs away to Mitzrayim. So it strikes me that this event that's going on with Achia Shiloni, when Achia Shiloni says, "Hey, you're going to lead a rebellion," what he's telling him is that I want you to start. If what I'm saying is true, Achia is not simply supporting an existing rebellion. He is promoting a non-existing rebellion. If that's true, this Navi is complicit. Morid B'Malchut, essentially. I mean, really, he's rebelling against the king, which is a terrific thing to say. I mean, terrific in a frightening sense, not really in a necessarily a good sense. Yeah. Good evening.
Can I ask why such a terrible thing for to build the Milo and repair the...
Yeah, we discussed that a little bit. I'm sorry, we can't tell you because you missed class. I don't want to prove it. I actually didn't prove it last week, and I'm not going to prove it this week either. But building the Milo, there are psukim that tie together the Milo with the house of Bat Paro. Chazal also tie it together, and it's provable from the psukim, although not from these psukim. The Milo was built so that Bat Paro's house would sit on top of it. It was a landfill in between Har Tzion, or Har Tavid, and Har HaMoriah. So if you can imagine it today, in between those two mountains, the landfill, my guess is that there was probably a steep ravine in between those two areas that was filled up with rocks or whatever it was. On that place was built Bat Paro. So that's why Chazal talk about how Shlomo was spending too much time with Bat Paro, and that's what Yerubim was criticizing him about, and there's some truth to that, even though they're speaking metaphorically. As far as the pratim go, the openings in the walls of Yerushalayim, it's hard to say what's going on there. So therefore, since we can establish a pasuk connection between the landfill, the Milo, and Bat Paro's house, then there are mepharshim that say that where did they get the rocks for the landfill to build Paro's house? It's like Chagadiah, Chagadiah. They built the house of Paro. How did they build the house of Paro? They filled in the Milo. How did they fill in the Milo? They knocked down some of the walls of Yerushalayim. Oh, sorry. No, that wouldn't make sense, because here they're filling in the walls of Yerushalayim, not knocking them down. So let me read I must have got the Parshan wrong, but it's here, so let me look it up. So this way I'm not misquoting like I almost did. Yud Aleph Chavchet. Sayin Chavchet. Chav Zion? Yeah, you're right, Chav Zion. Chav Zion, yeah, Chav Zion. This is Shlomo Banat Milo. So Rashi says like this, Binyan Zeh, this building, Sagar Teretz Ha'ir David. Oh, that building of the Milo, first of all, Rashi thinks the Milo is a building or construction. I think it's a landfill. I mean, I think everybody pretty much is sure that it's a landfill. But he sees it as a construction of some sort. Sagar Peretz David, which means one was really the other thing. It's not two separate things. It's not that he built the Milo and closed up. Also, A, he built the Milo, B, he closed up the openings of David. But it's A, he built the Milo, which was A, he closed up the, incidentally, he closed up the holes that David had made in the wall. Avicha parat pratzot b'chomal ikanes bolei rezalim. So David had opened up the city so that people could come in on pilgrimages. Vata gadarto tam lasot angariot lebat paro. And you closed it up in order to build this tower, this palace for Bat Paro. So really, what Rashi's doing is he's pulling it all together as one big sin. That is, the Milo was accidentally closed. That wasn't that Shlomo was going out of his way to keep people from coming up on pilgrimage. That wouldn't make any sense. However, he was putting his wife's needs, her house, above the needs of the people coming up Yerushalayim. I think Radak is a little more, I think there's something a little bit better to what, I don't want to go into Olden Beforshin here, but I think the way that I described it last time, and I believe it's the correct way to describe it, is that, as we saw before, Shlomo was a militaristic leader. We saw how Queen of Sheba complimented him on his military garb and on his servants. They were all garbed in a certain way, and you knew what their rank was. We saw he built these large Arei Miskanot, and he bought a lot of horses and chariots. You don't buy chariots to go horse riding in them. You buy them for war. He conquered a great deal of places. He had a tremendous amount of booty and taxes, and all other countries were subjugated to him. And we see that Shlomo, for better or worse, is a militaristic leader. I think we see that throughout the course of his life. My guess is that a militaristic leader closes up the walls of a city. That is what David did. David was a militaristic leader also. But I guess he was confident enough that he felt he wanted to knock down the walls of Yerushalayim so that people could simply walk in and they didn't have to go through, let's say, 3 or 4 gates. My guess is that in David's time that Yerushalayim was an open city rather than a closed city. My guess is that Shlomo turned it into a closed city. And what you're doing then is you're closing off Yerushalayim from the rest of your country. You're creating a real capital city where only the capitals can go. And I think that creates sort of a negative sense in the outback, if you will. There is something to what I'm saying. Tzudat David says like this. He says, Ma'az hayita putza chomat yer David. This walls of David were always open. Latzeif lavo ba el hamelech, so that anybody who wanted to could come to the king. Lahagish elav divrei ribotam, so it could come for court cases. V'hine Shlomo sagar haparza, he closed up the holes in the wall. Kilo eno chosheish lasot mishpat ha'am. He's no longer involved. Once he did, in the later part of his life, instead of taking it, remember what made Shlomo the king? The fact that two prostitutes or two of the lowest levels of people could come in and get a court case with the Supreme Court. That's a tremendous mila that David and Shlomo had. Anybody could walk in Yerushalayim. You didn't have to pay taxes. You didn't have to pass any guards. You didn't have to take a land tax test. You just walked in. You got a hearing. What the way that the Tzudat David understands this is the opposite of that. This is a way of closing off the city to the populace, because the minute you put a wall around the city, you are you're stating that it's no longer an open cosmopolitan city but a closed one. It's hard to say exactly. Rashi takes the simple way out. Rashi simply says that it's incidental. The building of the Milo accidentally closed off the walls to the city. But I don't think that's the pshat, and I don't think that's what the psukim seem to indicate. There seem to be two separate sins, and I think that these separate sins are together. The reason why he became militaristic is because he was copying the Egyptian society. So that they are related. The building of the Milo for Paro and the closing off the city is very much related, but they're not a single, they're two distinctive reflections of a problem that Shlomo would have in his later time. So that's my sense of the Milo and the Perichir David. But let's continue on and get a little bit to the actual rebellion. I guess returning to the point I wanted to make, Achia Shiloni is, my guess is that since we saw that he gave the same prophecy to, at least I believe, that he gave the same prophecy to Shlomo that he gave to Yerubba ben Nevat, I guess the Shlomo probably ran him right out of town. You know, I don't want to hear what you're saying. I'm not interested in you telling me that I'm not doing the right thing, so get out of town. I don't have to listen to you. At this point, Achia Shiloni probably felt the only choice he had was to actually go to Yerubbaal ben Nevat and put into... that's the question with the Navi. Is the Navi predicting the future, or is he... it reminds me of that thing in the Matrix, in the first Matrix, which was... she tells him not to worry about him knocking over the pot, so he turns around and knocks over the pot, and She says, what's really going to fry your noodle is if you would have knocked it over, hadn't and I said something. So that's the thing about prophecy. Prophecy is, to a certain degree, you could always say the reason why we're in these bad times is because you prophesy so. And in fact, a great deal of Sefer Yirmiyahu is just all about that. The reason why Babel's attack you in bad shape is because you said they would. And that's what they accused him of. They literally accused Yirmiyahu of bringing on the disastrous times with... And it's tough. Here's the trick about being a Navi. It's a very difficult job. A guy, you know, I always promise not to be political, and then I always say political things, but hopefully it won't take me too politically. If you're successful, nobody will ever know you're successful. I give you an example. This is a very harsh thing to say, but I'll try it. After 9/11, there have been no terrorist attacks on American soil. I believe that's correct. Does that mean Bush is being successful? You'll never know. You follow what I'm saying? It's impossible to know. That is, you can't argue from silence. You could always, therefore, say, no, the reason why nothing's happened is because nothing happened. You can never prove, when you stop evil or something bad from happening, you can never prove that it would have happened had you not. Unless you want to go and make it, you know what I'm saying? You can't, you're stuck, it's a conundrum.
Well, they caught people trying to infiltrate the country from Canada to blow up what's besides Seattle?
Yeah, that was, you're right, up in Canada. You're right, I'm making an extreme case that...
Shoe bomber, Mr. Padilla, and apparently the shooters in the Washington D.C. area had some likely motive, and there's speculation that the anthrax attack may possibly be related to that.
Right. Well, that's I agree. My muscle, my analogy is not really perfect, because
right.
In some cases you can demonstrate that somebody's doing a good job, but in many cases you'll just never know. Here's an example. I always wonder, you know, why do the cops go with their licenses, with their sirens blazing? Why don't they come up in secret to catch the bad guy? And then obviously when I got older I realized, well, they're not trying to stop a crime. They're trying to prevent it from even taking place. The very presence of police is there so that somebody won't walk. It's better not to catch somebody. It's better to avoid the whole situation in the first place. But by doing that, by doing your job right, you won't be able... Okay, you can point to statistics. There are less murders in the... And then somebody, you know, there's liars, there's damn liars, and statisticians. Somebody could take the same data and say, oh, no, it's not. It's because it was cooler in New York, so therefore nobody's killing each other in the streets. You could say anything you want, but the problem is when you're successful, when it comes to Nevuah, how are you supposed to know? You become an immediate Navi Sheker. And if it comes true, then people always say it came true because you said it was going to come true. And here's the trick. With Achia Shiloni, so that this is not just a philosophical class, but we're actually learning Sefer Melachim, Achia Shiloni is not only predicting what's going to happen, he's making it happen. And then the question is that the job of the Navi? Is, in fact, then that the job of the Navi? Is the job of the Navi not simply predict the future, but to attempt to change the future based on the way that God wanted it to change it, whether for good or whether for bad? You follow what I'm saying? And I think that's a...
It makes them political.
Absolutely. And the Navim were always political. That's what full of people... because of the Christianization of our Tanakh, so everybody's a leash, everybody's this nice, happy guy who does miracles and walks on water and does all kinds of nice things. That's not the way a Navi ever was. A Navi was always the best friend with the king, or the worst enemy of the king. They were always political characters. Sometimes there were military leaders as well. We'll get to a guy named Yonah. Remember the famous Yonah from the whale story? Everybody knows Yonah from the whale story, and hasn't that been Christianized, right? We have these big, you know, ever since Pinocchio, we have these big things about the whale, and he's sitting in the whale, and he's got, you know, I don't know, cables and everything he needs in the whale. I mean, it was a fish, for goodness sakes. But what they don't know is, we'll meet Yonah in Sefer Melachim. He's a military leader. He's a leader of Yerubbaal the second, not this Yerubbaal, but the second Yerubbaal's armies. They were always political. They were always on the move and making things happen. What? It is the same. There's no doubt. But Yonah ben Amittai, it's the same name. Absolutely, there's no doubt. No doubt.
And,
oh, absolutely political.
Right?
Oh my goodness.
He told his mother, you better get going, you better get hopping, or else you're not going to be around.
Our prophets were always activists, always activists. The idea of a passive prophet that spreads the word of God is an invalid idea, I don't believe, in Judaism. I don't believe it exists. It exists with the Christianization of Tanakh, but it doesn't exist in Tanakh itself. And here is sort of a classic, almost frightening example where Achia Shiloni is leading a rebellion against Yerubbaal. Now you can say that he's not leading a rebellion because he's not asking anybody to break any laws. What he's doing is splitting the kingdom in two. He's not taking the kingdom away from Rechavam. He's simply, and by the way, the Mepharshim all play a game with that, trying to, believe me, the Mepharshim are scrambling here to try to figure out how Achi Ashiloni is not committing a deathly crime, which is going against the king. But anyway, let's read a little more so we can get a sense of what's happening. Verse 30, chapter 11, verse 30 in Kings 1. So he takes very, prophets are also very into symbols, and he takes his new cloak, Asher Lav, he rips it into 12 pieces. So you take the 10 pieces. I'm ripping apart the kingdom from Shlomo, and I'm giving you 10 tribes. Verse 32. Everybody has a problem with the Shevet Achat, because 12 minus, people think the prophets aren't very good mathematicians, because 12 minus 10 is usually 2 and not 1. But what this means is, addition to Yehuda. That's right. Actually, Rashi, perhaps, and maybe Radak says that what they mean by one is that Yehuda. They mean literally one, that Yehuda and Binyamin were really reunited. Were united as a single tribe. But I don't think that's the simple meaning. I think the simple meaning is Yehuda was taken for granted because they're obviously not going to rebel against their own family. Yeah, verse 32 is interesting, actually. It has a word that's worth paying attention to. No, actually, I'm wrong. That word comes up a little bit further. But let's continue on. V'ashevet achad yelo l'man avdi David l'man yushlayim ha'ir asher b'charti ba mikol shetei Yisrael. So he says there are two reasons why I'm leaving him with these two tribes. One is for Israel, one is for David, and the other one is for Yushlayim. And that's very important, as I explained in previous classes, because Yushlayim, Har HaBayit, is not sitting on Yehuda's territory. It's sitting on Binyamin's territory. That's a very important idea. Har HaBayit is sitting on Binyamin's territory, and if Binyamin would have left to the north, they would have lost Har HaBayit as well, and that was not part of the plan. Achiyah was given no such jurisdiction to do that. Verse 33, Yan Asher HaZavuni. We actually talked about this verse, the fact that Chas V'Shalom Shlomo wasn't worshiping Avodah Zarah. His wives were, and here you get a sense of it, because instead of saying Yan Azavani, because he left me, it says Azavuni, they left me. So the prophet is not trying to blame Shlomo specifically. He's being very delicate on any accusations he lays against Shlomo. Verse 34, V'lo akachlo kol mamlecha v'yado. V'lo akach kol mamlecha v'yado ki nasi ashitenu. Kol yimei chayav l'man David avdi asher b'charti oto asher shamar mitzvotai v'chukotai. The word that's worth paying attention to here is the word nasi. I'll read it again. V'lo akach kol mamlecha v'yado, I won't take the entire kingdom away from him, ki nasi ashitenu, I will make him a nasi. Now, the normal in modern English, we translate the word nasi to prince. That would be a possible translation. I think president, actually, in modern English, I'm even president. I'd say, if you had one of those SAT tests, and you want to say, is nasi more like the word shofet, or is it more like the word melech? My guess is that there's a tendency to think it's more like the word shofet, and nasi is sort of like an elected position. You would have said it's more like the word melech.
As in ruler. As in Chumash.
I agree.
Ki nasi yechta is usually understood to mean a melech.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Or a prince of the tribe.
Yes, absolutely. I think that our modern Hebrew translation has shifted us away from the ancient translation. Here, there's a distinction between nasi and a melech. There's no doubt about it. But a nasi is close to a melech. In fact, in the Sefer Yechezkel, don't go looking for the word melech. Look for the word nasi. Now, you could argue that that's true because the nasi who was in charge, the melech who was in charge of Israel, his name was Tzidkiyahu, was not the true king. The true king was Yechoniahu, who was exiled some 12 years before. I think 12 years before by Nebuchadnezzar. So nasi does mean king. I think you could show that. But the fact that he's saying, I will make Shlomo a Nasi when he's already a Melech, indicates that there is a step down in the rule. That's my impression. And I think that the Navi is being subtle about it, but the point is quite there. Verse 35, Lakachti amucham yad b'no, I'll take the kingship away from his son, unatati alach, and I'll give it to you, et aseret ashvatim. That is the kingship of, specifically, the 10 tribes.
You give it to who?
Give it to, he's talking, Yerubim. Oh, this is Achi Ashiloni talking to Yerubim. Yerubim the first, or Yerubim ben Nevat. V'livno attain shevet achat, and I'll give him to his son, that is Rechavam, who we haven't met yet, I will give one tribe. This means in addition to Yehuda, that means Binyamin and Yehuda. L'man heyot near l'David avi kol ha'yimim b'fanai b'yushalayim. In order that he be a near to David, L'man heyot near l'David, in order that there be a near to David, my servant kol ha'yimim b'fanai b'yushalayim, in front of me Yushalayim, ha'ir asher b'charti lo l'asum shmi sham. That word near is an important word I think it pays attention to, because I think the natural desire to translate that word is as the word light, from the word ner. However, I would ask you, if you would, to take a look at your English translation that you have there, and if you could give me a sense of what you have there in your English translation.
A lamp.
A lamp, okay. That's in the Jerusalem Bible. Is there another translation here besides the, what does the article do with it? Verse
36, right? 36.
Yes.
And to his son, I said, give one tribe so that there may remain a dominion for the house.
A dominion. I have to, you know,
I'm
you know, dominion is, I think, better. I think dominion is better. Near, what's that?
Targum.
Malchuta, yeah, exactly right. The Targum goes with Malchuta.
Dominion.
Yeah, the word near doesn't really come from the word near. They're two different words. I'm not going to explain exactly why, but chirik is important there. The word ner does show up in Tehillim Kuf Lamed Bet, I believe. Let me just take a quick look if I remember correctly. Just a second. I believe it's Kuf Lamed Bet in Tehillim, and it's quite clear there. If I can find it in a second, I'll get it, but if I can't, if I have the wrong one, then I'll back off.
Do you think the words in...
No, the word ner is okay.
It's 42.
Yeah, kuf mem bet. You're absolutely right. Here it is. I'm looking at it right now.
Show up.
Where, it's 142?
Yeah,
I thought so too, but I can't find
it. Oh, I think so. It's the one that comes right after Malkut. That's 30.
Is it? Hold on. But I had it before and I lost it. Just a second. Oh yeah, here it is. Yeah, 132. It says, if you look in Tehillim 132, that's Kuf Lamed Bet. It says, starting from the last three pesukim, V'cho'aneha albish yesha, I will dress the priest with salvation, V'chasidecha ranenu ranenu, and the chasidim will sing, Sham atzmiach keren l'David, then I will put up a keren l'David. Now the question is, what does Karen mean? So Karen could be a ray of light, or it could, but I think the idea of Karen is, I think the idea is I will establish Karen David means, I don't think it really means light. I think it's talking about a throne, really, or rulership. And then it says, Arachti Ner Limshichi. The reason why Ner looks different than Ner as in a candle is because they're spelled differently. Ner as a candle is spelled Nun, it's Nun Reish by itself. Ner this way really should be Nun Resh Resh. There's two Reshes. That's why it reduces into Nir when you put the Yud in there. You know what? I'm into grammar land. Let me back off. But the bottom line is I believe the translation of the article, as much as I tend not to say this, but it looks like the article has the better translation, and Nir should be a throne to David. But going back to our issue...
As a lamp?
Lamp.
Yeah,
how do you like that? So the art scroll translation, it has to translate Karen there. What?
Pride,
yeah, I know. So it translates lamp there, but here it's the same word. Near and there are the same word. I'll give you an example. How do you say a tree? How do I say many trees? I'm sorry, I apologize. 8 and 18, that's true. Now how do you say an arrow? Chet, but how do you say many arrows? Chitzim. Why? Because the actual word is chatzatz. The chatzetz means to plunge an arrow in something. The chatzetz. There are actually two tzaddiks in that word. I'll give you an example. The word, well, you can't see it in the word har, but the real word is har, like harare kedem. A lot of words have double endings, but you don't sense the double endings because the last letter drops off. And what happens is the vowel undergoes a change. I'll give you an example, another example. Chetz Kitzim. Of course, now that I'm under pressure, I'm not going to think of it. What happens is when the letter drops off, the final letter drops off, Chetz Kitzim, so it's near, just like it's Chetz Kitzim, it's near, but near or nearim. Even though we don't have a plural here. You know what? I'm going to bore everybody with this grammar stuff. So I'll just erase that from that from my tape so that nobody falls asleep while listening to it. And let's just move on. But I think the word near is accurate as malchut. I think that's the best possible translation here. But what's interesting in the pasuk is that the pasuk is making it quite clear why, again, you have this twofold thing. Which means it's not only keeping things for David, but it's also in order to make sure that Yerushalayim stays a complete city. That's integral. That pasuk 37 is also worth a glance. Achiyashiloni looks at Yerubim, and he says, God says that he will take you, and I will make you a king. Now the question is how to translate kol taven nafshecha. There's two ways. Everything your heart desires. What is he really trying to tell them? He's actually, I don't know, how does he know that Yerubim ben Nevat doesn't want all of Israel, not just 10 tribes? Is that kind of like a blank check? I will give you everything that your heart desires. It's a very strange lashon. What's that? Vayita Melech al Yisrael. Yeah, I agree. So what's why not just say Umalachta b'chol? You know, why don't you say Vayita Melech al Yisrael? What is Umalachta b'chol Asher Tavan Nafshecha? That is, what message is being sent to Yerubim? What mandate is he supposed to have? What is he supposed to be thinking of when he sees b'chol Tavan Nafshecha? It just strikes me whenever I see extra words like that, I immediately think, where have these words shown up before? So they show up in some spooky places, actually. So if I may take you to one of them. In Shmuel Bet, I don't know if you want to go there, you can if you like to. In Shmuel Bet, 2 Samuel, chapter 3, is what happens is there is a split of the kingdom. David is ruling to the south, and a guy named Ish-Boshet, who is the only really remaining son of Shaul, is ruling to the north. But Ish-Boshet's a lousy ruler. He's actually not even ruling in the north. He had to go across the Jordan River because things got so hot for him. And he has the only person who's really sustaining the northern government is a guy by the name of Avner. Avner wants to be the king, really, so he takes the Pilegesh, he sleeps with the Pilegesh of Ish-Boshet, which is a powerful statement about my right to be the king. And Avner knows, everybody else knows, that Avner is the only guy who's keeping the northern kingdom alive. So Ish-Boshet gets upset with him, and how dare you sleep with my father's Pilegesh, with my Pilegesh, which is really trying to say, you're not going to be the king, you'll never be the king. So Avner says, okay, I've had it with you, I'm going to David. What does he say to David? Vayomer Avner el David. This is in chapter 3, verse 21. Vayomer Avner el David, Akuma v'alecha v'ekbatsa el Adonai ha-melech kol Yisrael. You know what, David? I'm going to go and I'm going to get everybody from Israel, and they're all going to unite with you. Vayichretu itcha brit. And they will come in with you, which means I'll get you those 10 tribes. Umalachta, and you will rule b'chol asher taveh nafshecha. That's a tough... that's tough. That's a powerful statement, because those words, which were Avner's, now this was a plot also, but it was a plot to unify the kingdom. So if you want, I believe what's going on here, B'chol Taven Ashecha, could be essentially, they're harsh words. They're trying to essentially say that what Avner did at one point, now Avner was not successful because Yoav had him killed, and it took a while until the kingdoms were united, but by and large at that point the kingdoms are united because there's really nobody left from Shaul to really be a viable king. But the same words which are used to unite the kingdom are the same words used to disunite the kingdom, and I think that there's something symbolic in those words. But there's someplace else those words also show up, was in Sefer Shemot. Sorry, in Sefer Dvarim. Anybody familiar with them in Sefer Dvarim? Exactly right. What's the problem? That's the Basa Taveh. What happens is, and this is a big machloket, I'm not going to get into this now, but the question is, do you have to be a vegetarian? I'm certainly not going to get into that, because then everyone will get in all kinds of trouble. But does Judaism really mandate vegetarianism? And is it only okay to eat meat when you're bringing korban in the Beit HaMikdash? You know, I know people always say, Ein simcha lo basar v'yayin, right? And that's why everybody always has meat on Shabbat. But obviously, what Ein Simcha Elo Basar V'Mayin is really talking about, they're talking about the Basar of the Korban, and they're talking about the Yayin of the Nesach of the Korban. They're not just talking about, it sounds almost Epicurean. I eat and I drink a lot of, I eat steak and I feel great about myself. That's not what Chazal was talking about. That's not what the Torah was talking about. In fact, there seems to be, and certainly there is a Deya, that you're not allowed to eat. You were not in the question was, in the Midbar, were they not allowed to eat meat at all in the Midbar? And then when they got into Eretz Yisrael, that is the only way they were allowed to eat meat, is if they came to the Beit HaMikdash and offered a sacrifice, and they could have part of the meat. It's called Basar Taveh. When they got to it, what? No, when they got to Israel, that's why in Devarim he says, when ki achib vulecha, when you'll have such a big land, and you won't be able to get to all Yerushalayim, and you'll have this Taveh for Basar, what are you going to do? So we'll set up a whole system of what's called shechting. And I heard actually Dr. Carmi on the matter, I think it was Rabbi Carmi, not Dive Carmi of YU, who was talking about, he actually did a good job of proving that the act of shechita, according to, I believe it was Rashi, is actually an act of kedusha, that you're actually, shechita is like a mini korban. It's actually a tremendous shiur, which really shed a whole new light on shechita. That is, the question was, there's a machloket whether in the Midbar, not where they couldn't have meat at all, but whether when they had meat, they didn't have to do shechting, whether it wasn't required. I didn't buff up on it, so I don't know it too well. I know there's some surprising things going on in Basar Taveh, but the bottom line is, when they came to Israel, they said, listen, you cannot do this. However, since I know that you can have broad borders, you're not going to be able to come to Yerushalayim, therefore I'll sanction eating meat, but only by shechting, and of course you have to cover the blood once it's spilled, depending on whether it's a chaya or a behema. What this indicates, however, is the same lashon that's used by Basar Taveh is also used by Maaser Sheni. What do I mean by that? Four out of every 6 years of the cycle of Shemitah, you were supposed to bring all of your goods to Yerushalayim and spend money and eat your food in Yerushalayim, eat your produce in Yerushalayim, or sell Yerushalayim. You're supposed to bring Yerushalayim. What would happen? People couldn't bring all their produce to Yerushalayim because this got too big. So therefore, God allowed a certain sanction called the pidyon on the Maaser Sheni, which was what? You could take your produce, you could exchange it for cash, you could eat your produce wherever you want. Your produce became now not holy, Maaser Sheni produce. The money became holy, so to speak, and you would take the money and go to Yerushalayim. Now I believe you could do whatever you want in Yerushalayim. You don't have to just spend it on Kodesh goods. You could certainly spend it on all edibles. You want to buy an ice cream in Yerushalayim with your pidyon money? That's perfectly fine. I'm not sure if you could buy non-food goods, but it's very possible that if you want to see a movie in Yerushalayim, you could use that Yerushalayim also. The idea was to support the economy, but the bottom line is that wasn't what the original goal was. The original goal was to bring your produce and make this massive market Yerushalayim, which means there seems to be sort of a b'diavad situation that is really, I want you to eat meat Yerushalayim. And I even want to say, I don't want you to eat meat anywhere else. But because I know that you have a Basar Taveh, so I'll sanction it. I'll give you a way to make it to happen. What does all this long build-up have to do with Yeravam ben Nevat? My question is, where was Yeravam ben Nevat supposed to do sacrifices?
Ideally, you should have had his people do it in Yerushalayim too.
Right, but that's not practical. He's got a lot of people. Then I will go to Yerushalayim. It's two different countries. So you're saying the ideal was, and we'll find out, by the way, that Yeravam builds a wall to keep people from going to Yerushalayim. And he does a lot of things to keep people from building Yerushalayim. But it's true. But I have a question. Was there Heter Bamot in the north?
What
do you know what I mean by Heter Bamot? Heter Bamot means people allowed to sacrifice in their own backyards. Now, Heter Bamot was allowed until Shiloh was built. That is, from the time that Yeshua crossed the Jordan River, people were allowed to make backyard mizbeach. If you've ever been to the Israel Museum, they actually have this, this big mizbeach that they've salvaged most of it. It has a little bit of plaster fill-ins, but it's the famous four-horn mizbeach. It's of a decent size. It's an impressive structure, and people will be able to do sacrifice. And all the honey, put a little Barbie on the grill. That's what you were talking about. You did a sacrifice out there. You gave a little bit to Hashem, and you ate the rest. Yourself. Only because they were living on the wrong side of the Jordan River. It's possible that they weren't allowed to because they were living on the wrong side of the Jordan River. They would have to come in and do it. What? Oh, that's true. Also, by then Shiloh was built. Yeshua built Shiloh in the end of his days. So there you could say that what they were doing wrong is instead of making... Once Shiloh was built, so religion became centralized. So maybe that's why they were criticized. That's a better answer than the one I gave. Why?
Jerusalem was so terrible
Right.
Yeah, so where could he sacrifice? He didn't come to sacrifice. Where could he do it?
Well, we know what he did. He did the worst possible situation. We're going to find out that he builds Beit El and Dan. And he, not only that, but he moves Pesach, he moves Sukkot by a month. We'll find out. He moves Sukkot by a month. And he causes all kinds of difficulties. But my question is, you know, I think I'm going too far then. When I was looking at this pasuk, I was speculating on the idea that maybe Yerubim had the right to give his people the right to do Hetzer Ebamo. Because how could people in a divided country really be expected to always do the sacrifice of Yerushalayim? So building Beit El is one thing. Keeping people from going to Yerushalayim is one thing. But what if somebody from Shevet Naphtali wanted to do some sacrifice? I don't want to say that that's correct. I was trying to look at the pasuk and seeing if maybe there was something to that. But it could be just Tavana. I think maybe I'm reading a little bit too much in Tavana Nafshecha. I'm not entirely sure, and I didn't look at the halacha of it, so I'd like to go to the halacha. But I wonder whether people had the right to do bamot in their own backyard, and whether that was an... I want to back away from that. I don't know, it's too audacious. I was playing that out with the word Tavana Nafshecha, and I'm trying to tie in Tavana Nafshecha with Sefer Dvarim. But the truth is I'm shooting too far. I'm throwing a Hail Mary instead of going closer. I think the better example, by the way, is the fact that Avner said to David, you're going to rule in whatever you're going to want to rule, and then when the kingdom was undone, so the same words were used. I think that's better than my whole stuff about Sefer Dvarim. But I think I opened up a Pandora's box. I'm sorry, what did you want to say?
He was doomed.
So
what should he have done? He was expected to do something that nobody told him to do.
Yeah, you're right. He was expected to go to allow his people to go to Yerushalayim.
You're of them.
That's politically very difficult.
Yeah, correct.
So the one hand you say, okay, because they were seen as the enemy.
Correct. Unless, again, there we get with my Heter Bamot idea, makes it a little easier. If people have Heter Bamot, so it's not such a problem. People want to go to Yerushalayim, they go to Yerushalayim. They want to do it in their backyard, they do it in their backyard. But there was no need in that case for Yerubim to set up an alternate place of worship to keep people from going to Yerushalayim.
And make
it the Baal. Wait. What? Did you say Baal?
And make it
the
Baal.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. We're going to get into Yerubim. No, it wasn't at all. I have strongly held all of my life, my opinion to hold, that Egel Zahav was worshiping God in the wrong way. And I'll try to prove that as we get there, actually, with next chapter. Chapters from now.
If they
what?
Back to Yerubim, they would be welcome.
Oh, that's an interesting political question also. You're right. How could a guy from the north just walk through? Would it be like Slovak and Czech, or would it be like Serbia and Bosnia?
Like
that's
West
the question.
Like West Germany.
And East Germany, right. Well, we'll see. There was a wall built. We'll see. There was, in fact, a wall. But anyway, I think I spent too much time speculating. I just thought they were interesting words, and I always, whenever I see a word like that, it maybe look things up, but obviously sometimes you get a little carried away with it, which I may have. Anyway, let's continue on, so I think we should at least try to finish the chapter, which we should in the next 10 minutes. Verse 38. By the way, the word bayit, vanita bayit, doesn't mean you build a physical house. A bayit is to be shown, actually means what do you call it when one king gives to the next king his son? What is that called?
Inheritance.
What? What's the word? Not inheritance. Something better than inheritance. When a king sets up a dynasty. A dynasty. Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. A bayit means dynasty, and actually I could demonstrate that from what's that?
Right.
Yes, good, even in modern English. What? Yeah, that's what it means here. It doesn't mean a physical house. It means a dynasty. So essentially God gives him the standard promise, which is that I'll give you Israel if you keep my Torah laws. Now, Pasuk Lamed Tet is, in my opinion, a blockbuster. Va'aneh et zera David l'manzot. And I will cause pain. The word aneh, the Aleph, by the way, is not supposed to be there. If you notice, the Aleph has no nekudot on it, over it, around it, near it, nothing. What that means is the letter should be silent, should be ignored. That's the way the Masoretes told you the word should be ignored. The classic example of that is Yisachar. If you look at Yisachar, it doesn't have dot over it, under it, anywhere on it. Now, let me be more accurate. Except at the end of a word. Right, that's an exception. If a letter that is anywhere but the end of the word has no vowels on it or no punctuation on it, it is meant to be silent. That's what the Masoretes were telling you. That's the way they made it to make sure that you'd skip it. So in this case, the word Yaneh would normally have a Shva under the Aleph or something. What they're telling you is the Aleph doesn't belong there. It's Creek Tiv, essentially. It was written with an Aleph, and somebody at some point simply said the Aleph is not supposed to be there, and that's generally accepted. I don't want to get into the issue of Aleph being a vowel sound, actually, because that gets complicated. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, we find the Aleph is very often used as a vowel sound. For instance, ki, the word ki, as in because, is not spelled, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's not spelled Kaf Yud, it's spelled Kaf Yud Aleph. Kaf Yud Aleph. But I don't want to get into that issue right now. So he says, Vayana, I will cause pain, or I will punish, or I will afflict, or I will make them poor. Et zera David lemanzot, because of this. Now, of course, they never say what this is, but it seems pretty obvious because of all the things that Shlomo did. Ach lo kol hayamim. Now, that's important. Ach lo kol yamim, but not forever. But the question is, what is ach lo kol yamim modifying? What is it saying? When I say, but I'm not going to do it forever, it must be modifying a verb. So what verb is it modifying that's not going to be going on forever? That's my question for you.
Making the pain.
That seems to be, that's the easiest implication. That is, I won't cause them pain forever. And the Mefarshim most take it that way, and they say, what does that mean? And in times of Mashiach, they'll all be happy. However, some other Mefarshim are very confused. Why? Because some kings did very well. Not every single king of Israel, sorry, every king of Judah did badly. Some of them did very well. Some of them were not pain, some of them were not suffering. Rechavam, we'll see, will suffer like a dog. But other ones did very nicely. So people say, well, it means because you could have had 12 tribes and now you only have 2 tribes, so that's a pain also. However, it's possible to understand ach lo kol hayamim modifying a different verb. Take a look back a little bit of Pasuk. Do you know what verb it could be modifying? It could be modifying the entire previous Pasuk. If you listen to my laws and you keep the way things are supposed to keep, I'll build you a dynasty. Did you see what it says? Kasher bani, I will build you a dynasty. Kasher bani latati l'chayv Yisrael ach lo kol hayamim. Did you follow? That's much nicer, actually, and much nastier. And I, do you follow? That is, there are two promises.
I follow it's much nicer and much nastier.
Well, what he's saying to Yerub, what he's saying to Yerubim is, you're now king until I decide that you're not. Go. Start now, but not forever. It's different than saying, he's talking to him, and he's saying, I promise you I'm going to make you a king of all northern Israel as long as you're good and you do the right thing. And then Yerubim's like, wow, if I do the right thing, my dynasty will last forever and ever. If I do the wrong thing, okay, I do the wrong thing. That's my problem. And by the way, I have some other piece of information that the prophet just happens to be giving me, which is that David's family will be tortured or will be pained, but they won't be pained forever.
Well,
who cares?
What's that?
So if you translate as Yaneh as that they will lose the kingdom, that is, they will only rule out of 2 instead of 10, then Ach Lo Kol Hayamim means the day that you lose your dynasty is also the day that they get back all 10.
Well, how else do you translate it?
Well, I think Yaneh usually means to pain or to torture, and they weren't looking at simply the loss of the 10 tribes as being a pain and torture, but something happens afterwards. Let me see if I have the portion here on that. The word it's true, if you translate Yaneh as the fact that it will be pained by losing the 10 tribes, then Ach Lo Kol Yamim means it will get those tribes back.
Then it will be pained and tortured by the fact that Yerovam and his heirs are in power over their country. You're not talking about the 10 tribes, you know, whatever. It's just that they've got to feel the deprivation, which is, you know, like the constant sword in their side.
That's true. However, I want to, in the last few minutes, I want to raise your eyes, at least insert into your thoughts the idea of the messianism built into this pasuk. If you assume that this pasuk is talking about the loss of the 10 tribes, Ach Lo Kol Hayamim means the 10 tribes will be returned to the kingdom. Mm-hmm. That never happened in Sefer Melachim. Never fully, I should say. Not completely. That is, Yoshiah would wind up getting some of the tribes back. But by and large, the tribes were exiled. Because Giao, no, he never unified.
He invited
it was,
everyone to join the permanent.
It was his sixth year that a guy named Sargon the Great, Sargon the Second came, and he exiled all the northern tribes. That was in Chizkiyahu's sixth year. Yoshiah never even knew about the northern tribes. They were already gone. They were gone. He reconquered the land. and there was no doubt some remnants of the tribe still left, but by and large the tribes had been lost beforehand. David never did get back to 10 tribes. Therefore, if you say that the word la'anot to cause you limitation or pain is specifically to take away the 10 tribes, then if ach kol hayamim means, but that won't happen forever, it means the 10 tribes will return under David's rule, and then this pasuk is absolutely messianic. That's fine. I'm not saying that that's not an acceptable translation. Not only is it not an acceptable translation, but it's a closer read, because ach lo kol yamim is modifying, the closest verb that it's modifying is the inui in the same pasuk in verse 39. However, it's possible that that's not what it means. It is possible that what it means is that your kingdom, your personal bayit, will not last forever. And by the way, that doesn't even mean the north. It can mean Yerubim's personal house doesn't last forever, but other people will rule the north. And that did happen. In fact, Yerubim didn't last a long time at all. Yerubim had a good rule. He had one son. His son that was supposed to take over died. He had the next son that made it 2 years, and that was the end of his kingdom. That was the end of his kingdom. He didn't make it a long time at all. So that may be what is spoken about here. There was a really good part. We only have... Yeah, it's a 10 after, so we'll stop here. I didn't get to the last part. I want to give you a little bit of a dangler. If you take a look in Pasuk Mem Aleph, it says, Vayeter Devrei Shlomo, the words of Shlomo, V'chol Asher Asa, and everything that he did, V'chokhmato, and his wisdom, Halo Heim Tuvim Al Sefer Devrei Shlomo. That's unusual. It's usually the Devrei Hayamim Lamelech Yudah, Devrei Hayamim Lamelech Yisrael. What is this Devrei Shlomo? And by the way, it doesn't say Sifrei, it's a Sefer. So the question is, what are we talking about here? So the ideas of this, what Sfarim did Shlomo write, etc., etc. So this is something that we'll spend a little bit of time in, and then we'll finish off. I apologize. Next time we'll finish off these four psukim, and then we'll get into the actual rebellion and Perek Yud Bet. This book is no longer extant. That's right. That's correct. Well, unless it's Kohelet. Well, that's exactly what the